Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the ramifications of change and how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community. This program is an extension and production of Action for Healthy Communities and it's provided in collaboration with KCBX. Central Coast Voices is made possible through generous underwriting by Joan Geller Sargent. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. Talking about your end-of-life wishes can be both difficult and necessary, but making sure that your loved ones and doctors know what kind of medical treatment you want is both a very important and vital step in receiving the medical care in line with your values and choices if you're unable to speak for yourself. National Healthcare Decisions Day is dedicated to helping Americans start conversations about advanced care planning and exists to inspire, educate, and empower the public and providers to take action because avoiding these decisions can lead to unwanted care, ineffective treatments, and suffering for patients and their families. My guest for today's discussion is Dr. Karen Wyatt, a hospice physician for over 25 years and author of the book, What Really Matters, Seven Lessons from Living from the Stories of the Dying. She's the creator and host of the End of Life University, an online interview series that touches on all aspects of the end of life. And this past month, she's been asking people to join her in a 10-day challenge to get their wishes in writing. Today's show is live, and you can be a part of our discussion by calling us at area code 805-781-3875. Again, we are live today, and you can join our discussion at 805-781-3875. 3875. And Dr. Wyatt, are you there?
I'm here, Chris.
Hi. Thank you for joining me by telephone. I appreciate you're willing to call in and be a part of today's show.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, we've got lots of things that we can talk about because just perusing the End of Life University, there are so many different topics around this subject. But I want to start with first, the very core thing of today's show is the National Healthcare Decisions Day and the issue around advanced healthcare directives. And we hear that term, how it's important, but how many people actually have an advanced healthcare directive?
Well, from surveys I've read and the studies that they've done, they're guessing around a third of our adult population have probably completed an advanced directive, which is really not enough, not nearly enough people who've completed that paperwork.
And when we're talking about an advanced healthcare directive, what exactly are we talking about? What is that?
Well, one component of it is the living will, which is where you make a declaration about what type of care you would like or not like to have at the end of life. If you are in a state, say you're in a comatose state and unable to speak for yourself. So it's a legal document that allows healthcare providers to make decisions whether or not you should be continued on life support if you can't breathe for yourself, or if you should not be placed on that kind of support. So the living will gives directions to the medical team about what kind of care you would like. But also one really important document is appointing a healthcare proxy or a person who will speak for you if you can't speak for yourself. So that person will meet with doctors and influence the decisions that are made on your behalf. And some people say that's actually the most important choice you should make, is one person who's been empowered to stand up for you and speak if you can't represent yourself.
So, without that paperwork in place, who's making the decisions?
Well, many times if it comes down to a legal issue, A court may decide that the nearest living relative is the person who makes a decision. And that might not be the person who's the best equipped to make a choice for you. In an emergency situation, the medical staff caring for you will make a decision, and what they will offer you is what we think of as the default medical care, which means they will do everything. If they don't have instructions or directions that tell them that there is a type of care you would like withheld, they'll do everything. And that might mean putting you on a ventilator, maintaining, doing CPR to restart the heart, using medications and IVs in order to try to keep the body alive as long as possible.
And so this is regardless of the age, correct? Of the age of the person? Okay.
Yes.
And when we're talking about nearest living relative, am I understanding correctly that it may be that my nearest living relative is a brother who I haven't had any communication with in 4 years, who lives out of the area, and not necessarily my roommate?
Yes, absolutely. So the court could appoint someone that you really don't see eye to eye with and who doesn't really know you that well or know what your wishes are, who might make decisions that would go against what you would prefer to have for yourself.
When we're talking about every living adult, we're hoping that every living adult would feel empowered to create this document for themselves. What age are we talking about? You know, from what age to what age should have this?
Well, the recommendations really are that everyone over the age of 18 should have an advance directive, because anything can happen at any time, and a younger person could be in an accident or could have, a sudden life-threatening illness occur. And so it's important for everyone over the age of 18 to have thought about their wishes and put it in writing in some way so that other people know what they would like.
Now, Dr. Wire, you, before you became a physician that was focused in hospice care, you were a primary care physician, correct?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. And from your experience of working with your patients, what do you think is the biggest, what are the bigger reasons that people don't do an advanced healthcare directive?
I think that some people don't even know that it's important and may not even have heard about it or thought about it. And others are afraid of having the conversation and really thinking about the end of life and what could happen. And then I do think some people realize that they should do it, but imagine that they have plenty of time, that this they can get to this years from now. They don't need to think about it right now.
But something critical, like you mentioned, it could be a critical illness, could happen, or an accident could happen to anybody at any age.
Yes, exactly. And so that's why we're trying to encourage people, don't connect creating these documents with having an illness. Think of it more as just something that, as an adult, that you should take care of and that you should have created, and just to be part of the paperwork that you have. And you can be in perfect health and you might never even need the advance directive, but
right,
it's just something that you have as a safeguard for the future.
When people say to you, well, I have a trust, and so I have that advance directive in my trust, is that the same thing?
It's possible that, at least I know when we created my husband and I created a will, we did sign a living will with our attorney, but it's not at all the same thing, because we signed that form without any education about what it meant or how it could be used. It was a piece of paper the attorney handed us to sign. And so it's really important that people not get false reassurance from the fact that they might have created some paperwork with their attorney, but to make sure they have actual forms that they've reviewed with their doctor and talked about with their loved ones that clearly specify what they would like to have at the end of life.
Now, I know.
And those,
go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, those conversations are one of the most important parts of creating the advance directive. It's actually talking with other people about the wishes as well.
When you were doing primary care, did you very frequently have your patients come in and talk about their values, about their health care, their health care decisions, what they wanted or didn't want?
No, almost never. It was very rare that patients would bring up that conversation or talk about it. And from some of my colleagues I speak with now in primary care, most of them are saying the patients don't bring it up to them. The doctors are trying to figure out how to bring it up with patients.
Is that a conundrum for physicians to go down that path? Does it feel awkward or...
Definitely, most physicians say because they're not sure how the patient will react to it, and they're afraid that if they say, "Have you filled out a living will?" the patient might panic and think, "What are you hiding from me? What's wrong with me that you're
right.
not telling me about? Is that what's prompting you to ask this?" And so, for a lot of doctors, that's an obstacle they can't overcome. They're afraid of upsetting the patient, so they just don't mention it.
So when you were acting as a primary physician, you weren't bringing that topic up a lot to your patients, correct?
No, at that time, because that was before I had gotten involved in hospice
right.
care, and I didn't really recognize the importance of it or mm-hmm. understand that yet.
And then how did you switch your languaging so that you could present situations? Because in dealing with hospice patients, not all of them were going to be dying imminently, correct? And
yeah,
so there's still yeah. wishful thinking, I would think, and an avoidance.
Yes. Well, one thing that I learned to do is to normalize the process and to say, here's something that I talk to all of my patients about, regardless of their health, of the status of their health,
mm-hmm.
and all of my adult patients, regardless of their age. This is just something I mentioned to everyone. And I would also say, you know what? I recently filled out this paperwork for myself because mm-hmm. I found out how important it is. So I would include myself in it as a way of making sure it didn't sound like the patient was being singled out as someone that I believed was going to die very soon.
When you're talking with people, because having this conversation, and I mentioned in the in the prologue coming in that we recognize that having these conversations about our wishes, should something happen, we can't make decisions for ourselves, but it's toward the end of our life. That's not a pleasant thought necessarily, and it's certainly one that a lot of us want to avoid. A lot of us are also having these conversations with other people in our lives, like our parents and grandparents. How do you give direction, or what have you found in direction for other people to open the dialogue around those things?
One thing, and this was actually personal for me with my own mother when I wanted to have a conversation about her wishes, I started by asking her how it was for her when her parents died. And so she told me the stories for both her mother and father and what happened. And she actually was delighted to tell that story. It was something she had wanted to talk about.
Hmm.
So I just listened to what she went through and what happened as her parents were dying. And she told me about all the things that she didn't like about it and all the things that she wished had been different about their deaths. So then I could go on and say, what would you like to be different for you, Mom, when that time comes for you?
Mm.
And that just opened up the whole conversation and made it so much easier for us to go there and really talk about some of the specifics.
Yeah, so it really made it a memory lane kind of conversation.
Yes. Yes, and there was an easy connection for her to see,
yeah.
like, oh no, my mother got taken in an ambulance and they did CPR on her three different times in the hospital and it was terrible for her. And I wish that hadn't happened. And so that made it easy for me to move on from there and to even say there's a way that we could prevent that from happening for you that we didn't know about when grandma was dying, but we have this available now.
That's great. I'm going to get back to that in just one second, Dr. Wyatt. This is Chris Kington-Barker, and you're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX HD1 San Luis Obispo, KNBX HD1 San Ardo, and KSBX Santa Barbara. Today's show is about National Healthcare Decisions Day with a focus on helping Americans start conversations about advanced care planning and exist to inspire, educate, and empower the public and providers to take action, because avoiding these decisions can lead to unwanted care, ineffective treatments for both the patient and the family suffering. My guest for today's discussion is Dr. Karen Wyatt. She's the creator and the host of End of Life University, an online interview series that touches on all aspects of the end of life. Her most recent focus on Healthcare Decision Day, she was asking people to join her for a 10-day challenge to get their wishes in writing. You are invited to join our discussion with your comments and questions about today's topic. You can call us at 805-781-3875. Again, 805-781-3875. And Karen, you were saying that with your mom, one of the things that she narrowed in on as being something she wanted to avoid was the CPR aspect.
Yeah.
And you have also said that we now have some things that are different, that, you know, that seems to come up a lot as being an area that people have a lot of myths and misunderstandings about. Can you talk a little bit about some of that?
Yes. And I think that for most people, their awareness or exposure to CPR, which is cardiopulmonary resuscitation, has really come from television programs and movies. Programs like Grey's Anatomy or ER and House on television, where they might have seen patients who have a code, they have a cardiac arrest in the hospital, and a code is called and a team rushes in and they do compressions of the chest and breathe for the patient, and suddenly the patient wakes up and they're fine. The life is saved and the patient is completely fine and walks out of the hospital the next day. And I think that's actually fairly common from studies they've shown in television programs. But in real life, that is not what happens. And particularly using CPR in elderly, more frail patients, the statistics are very grim that only about 3% of patients actually survive after CPR. And those who do are more likely to have some sort of brain damage and may never wake up again or never return to any kind of normal function after CPR. So we know it's very ineffective for patients who are frail and who are actually nearing the dying process anyway. And in my training, this was one of the most traumatic experiences, I think, for all of us in residency training, is being called to do CPR on elderly patients and we knew that it was their time to die. And yet we were in the position of having to try to resuscitate them and pressing on their chests and breathing for them to try to bring their bodies back to life. Knowing it, still that it would be futile, but we didn't have a means of not doing that because that was part of our default care. And those patients who didn't have a directive saying, I don't want CPR, we had to do that code and we had to do CPR on them.
And, you know, for people who are not familiar with this, too, when CPR is started, once it is started, either in an ambulance or in the hospital, it's continued for a period of time.
Yes, yes, for several or many minutes. And so
and can be continued as long as an hour or a half
yes,
hour.
Yes, it can yes. be. Yeah, it, yes, it can. It can go as long as an hour. And it, even if the heart rhythm restarts a bit, then the CPR could happen over and over again and be repeated multiple times.
The other thing that sometimes is not shown that has been mentioned is that it's not just the CPR or putting paddles on a person and introducing electrical shock, but there are a lot of medications that are used that are given that may stimulate some heart action without the heart actually fully functioning as it normally would, correct?
Yes, yes. So it may appear like on the tracing that there's some beats from the heart, but it may just be from the medications that have been given. So, and the other thing that we are aware of is that it's a very painful process for the patient to experience. Many times ribs are broken by the compressions because of the depth of the amount of pressure that has to be applied in order to push against the heart. And so we know that it causes suffering for patients. And as I was saying, oftentimes to no benefit. And that's a horrible situation to be in as a resident, to be required to do that procedure to a patient knowing that it won't help them and that it's causing suffering.
If someone has not, though, stated at a hospital their wishes around this, if their heart were to stop and a staff person were to find them as the heart were stopping, they would do CPR, is that correct?
Yes, because it is the default level of care, and in absence of some other type of order or some other direction, it's kind of the baseline care that does get offered in an emergency situation.
Talk, you know, can you do a quick comparison in your hospice work with patients, the difference between being around those patients as they're dying or a patient who's being administered treatments that everybody knows are not going to work?
Yes, I had an experience when I was on call in the hospital during residency with a very elderly man who had a cardiac arrest. His heart stopped beating, and the code was called, and I was the resident on call. It was in the middle of the night, so I'm the doctor who got up to run to be there for the code. We were doing CPR on the patient, and the nurse came in and said the man's only living relative was a nephew that she had called by phone to talk to him, and she explained to him what had happened and that we were doing CPR, and she asked him if he would like us to change our treatment, and he said, do everything you can to keep him alive, and she said, then are you coming in to be with him? And he said, no. And hung up the phone. But his instructions were, do everything you can. And that poor man, his heart did start beating again. He never woke up, never regained consciousness, but we ended up doing CPR on him 5 different times during the night before finally our last attempt didn't revive his heart, and he died. But I knew all night that we were really torturing him. And I knew that, you know, this poor man, we needed to be able to die in peace, and we were torturing him. But in contrast, a patient in hospice who was of a similar age, and she was a retired nurse. She was our hospice patient also with severe heart disease. And on her last day of life, she was at home with her daughter and granddaughter taking care of her. She got to hold her great-grandchild on her lap on her last day of life and play with her. And she was just surrounded by people who loved her as she was in her favorite recliner at home when she took her last breath. And, in that moment when I was there and saw her on that last day, I felt so grateful that I'd found my way to hospice medicine, where we were able to actually do the right thing and help people have a peaceful and beautiful death at home with loved ones around them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm going to take a call from Sandra from Arroyo Grande. Sandra, are you there?
Hi, yes, I am. And I'm actually so thankful that Dr. Wyatt is talking about this issue, because I have been a critical care nurse for 16 years myself, and I actually did hospice for a while. And in my experience, I can't tell you how many times I have done assessments on elderly people, and I ask them, like, what would you like, have you discussed with your family, what would you like to have done at the end of life? Nobody has ever had that discussion.
Yeah.
But furthermore, the one more thing I wanted to talk about is about advanced directives. I do agree, Dr. Wyatt. I'm so glad you're talking about this. Everybody should have an advanced directive for medical care. I would go one step further, because I have seen patients come in with advanced directives, but then they have an absent family member who's not seen the family in a long time, and now all of a sudden they feel guilty, and they said, no, do everything. And in my experience, doctors do not want to be involved in legal matters, so they will go against the advance directive because they don't want to be called to a lawsuit. So I would say that patients need to have a pulse, which is physician's orders for end of life. And basically, that overrides anything. That cannot be legally challenged because the patient has signed with the doctor and everything. And that, in my experience, is the only thing that cannot be legally challenged. But advanced directives is a great thing. I am so glad. Thank you for doing this.
And Sandra, I have a question for you. Do you have an advanced healthcare directive?
I don't have an advanced healthcare directive myself, but my husband, who is my only relative here, is very, very aware of what I want done. And in fact, he's a physician himself, and he says that he is making somebody else his person in charge of making medical decisions, because he is afraid that he's ever had to cough, I'll sit, put him on a hospice.
Okay.
No, but it's so important to have that. And it's a topic that is very dear to my heart.
Okay. Thank you for calling, Sandra.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Kieran.
Yes.
Yeah. One of the statistics that I read, I think it was sent to me this week by someone, was that in a survey, what they were able to determine is only about 41% of individuals who work as hospice workers have an advanced healthcare directive.
That's interesting. Not that much better than the general public.
Yeah, still better. I think the general public was probably, 25% to one third. But, you know, so let's assume that for Sandra's case, that both she and her husband were in a car accident, and there's no written advanced healthcare directive. This is what you're talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
That in a situation like that, if you're trusting that one person, that there's one individual that can speak, that knows you, knows your wishes, and can speak for you, they're incapacitated too. Then what? Do you have a recommendation in doing an advanced healthcare directive that there be some people that are like on the bench?
Yes, they actually recommend that you have two alternates after your healthcare proxy, so that there are a few more people down the line who know your wishes and know what you want and are willing to take on that responsibility and speak up for you. So it's really not enough to think of just one person. It's important to have a team in line, really, of people who will speak up for you.
And the Advanced Healthcare Directive here in California, and Dr. Wyatt is actually a resident of Colorado, and so, but, and I don't know what your laws are for advanced healthcare directive there. Here in California, it does not need to be notarized. You need to have two people sign, who are not named as your proxies in the advanced healthcare directive.
Yes. And it cannot be your physician either,
right,
or anyone on the physician staff that, that signs it as well. And that's true in Colorado also.
Right, right. Okay. So there are a myriad of different forms. Do you have a certain kind of advanced healthcare directive that you found works better for people?
Well, for my mother, we use the Five Wishes form from Aging with Dignity, and I filled one out. Mom and I filled these out at the same time so that we could go through question by question together and talk them over. I've heard lawyers say that the Five Wishes form has some loopholes in it, and especially because it allows you to say, I just want the doctor to make a choice for me. So I have had people say that might not be the best form that's out there. But what I loved about Five Wishes is that there are places where you can talk about how you want your family to remember you,
right,
and special things you might like to have with you at the end of your life. And that for me was very sweet. In fact, I still have my mom's Five Wishes form that she wrote out by hand. So I have her handwriting and I have what she wrote in that paragraph about how I want to be remembered. And it's very touching. For us, that form worked really well.
Yeah. And now people can go and they can fill that out online as well, because it is a purchased form if they don't get it locally.
Yes.
I mean, it's not expensive.
About eight states that also require the state living will forms as well. You have to have them attached. You can use Five Wishes if you also have completed your state's living will, but you can go on the website for Aging with Dignity to find out about that.
Okay. And there's also a website, the Coalition for Compassionate Care in California has downloadable samples of advanced healthcare directives that people can use as a format. Also here in California, people can write it on a piece of paper. It doesn't have to be a legal form. It does need to have certain components. It has to have a date. It has to have who they are. It needs to have their signature, and it needs to have two witnesses. But I think we sometimes make things so much more complex than the most complex thing is starting the conversation, right?
Yes, absolutely. And just recently, I had someone who joined the 10-day challenge to do his advanced directive, and he said, when I get this done, I'm going to put it in my filing cabinet with my will and documents. And I said, well, that's okay, but you have to make a lot of copies of it and take it to other people and talk to them about it, because it won't help you if it's in your filing cabinet and no one knows it's there. No one even knows that you created the document. It won't help you. So it's so important that we emphasize that.
Yeah. Do you find that people create this, they have it signed, and they've never had the conversation with the person that they've named as their proxy, really around not only what their choices are, but why they made those choices? Because if I was to say, I don't want to be placed on life support, if I'm, you know, if there's no reasonable chance of me recovering and gaining capacity, there's a bigger dialogue around that for me than, no, I just don't want life support.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I actually had someone call in when I was on another show and say, I'm proud to say I have an advanced directive, and I named my son as my healthcare proxy. He doesn't know it yet, and I don't really want to tell him because he might not be happy about it. And I said, that defeats the whole purpose. He won't know. He'll get a surprise call one day from a hospital saying, you've been named as a healthcare proxy, and he will have no idea how to make those decisions or choices or what to say about it.
Absolutely. This is Central Coast Voices, and I'm your host, Chris Kington-Barker, on KCBX Public Radio, airing from Salinas to Santa Barbara and around the globe on the web at kcbx.org. My guest for today's show is Dr. Karen Wyatt, a hospice physician for 25 years, and author of the book, What Really Matters, Seven Lessons for Living from Stories of the Dying. She's the creator and host of End of Life University, an online interview series that touches on all aspects of the end of life. And this past month has asked people to join her 10-day challenge to getting their wishes in writing. Do you have an advanced healthcare directive? Was it hard or easier than you thought it would be? We'd love to include you in today's discussion. You can join us at 805-781-3875. And I'm going to go to Susan. Hi, Susan. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome.
Thank you. I have a question, which is I am a retired physician, and I do outreach education on options in end-of-life care. And the thing that people are always asking about is, what if I become demented? How do I prevent myself from living on and on as a demented person? And I wonder if the doctor has any suggestions on what to say to those people, which is like 90% of the people I talk to, that's their question.
That's their fear and their question.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's their fear. And the question is, how do I prevent it?
That is such an important question to ask, and I think it's going to be coming up more and more often as we baby boomers get older and start dealing with the potential of dementia and Alzheimer's. And so one option, and everyone should have an advance directive, and I'm reading that there's some consideration of making allowances for Alzheimer's, and an allowance that would allow people to indicate they don't want to be fed if they cannot feed themselves when they have Alzheimer's. They don't want to have any sort of artificial means of feeding them, or even to be fed if they can't do it for themselves, and that they can be allowed to refuse food if they do have dementia, and that will be respected. So I don't know where that is. I don't think that's a legal option right now, but there is an option to stop eating and drinking before the dementia becomes so severe that the patient can't make that decision for themselves. And there's a wonderful book called Choosing to Die by Phyllis Schachter, and her husband Alan had Alzheimer's, and while he was still had enough of his faculties to make the choice, he decided to stop eating and drinking in order to die before his Alzheimer's progressed to end stage, and her book tells the story of that. And that is a legal option that people have. A patient can refuse food and drink and has a legal right to do that. So for right now, that's one option that's out there, and I think Phyllis's book could be very informative for people who want to learn more about that.
And
can people put it in their advance directives that if they become unable to feed themselves, that they want food and drink withheld?
Well, what I've heard, and I don't know exactly where this is right now, but I've heard that there's consideration of making that part of the advance directive. But I'm not sure right now about the legality. So my fear of it is that there needs to be... Phyllis has some really clear guidelines about how they protected her legally to make sure that no one would accuse her of abusing her husband when he himself made the choice to not eat or drink. And so it's in her book. Right now, I don't think the advance directive offers that. And I don't know if you know that, Chris. I've just been reading that that's a consideration. for the future.
Susan, do you have the answer to that?
I only know what my the lawyer who made my will said, that if I said it clearly enough, that it could stick, and that would then once demented, I hope I never get there, but, you know, if I were demented, and I said, oh, no, I want something to eat or drink, that that my advance directive would take precedence over that. And I have to say, you know, I talked about this with my family. I sent around my, you know, what I had written, and I said, does anybody have any problem with this?
Right.
And everybody said, oh, can we use that in our advance directives? So this is, and this is, you know, this comes up just often. Every single time I talk to people, this concern comes up. And I was just wondering if you had experience with that or a more definitive answer. But I think we're, I understand what you're saying, and I will definitely read the book.
Yes, especially because she has a lot of resources in it and can tell you exactly the steps that she and Alan followed to make it airtight, to make sure there were no legal questions about it.
Was he at home or in an institution?
He was at home. She cared for him at home. With they had some paid caregivers who helped her with this care.
And
thank
it's,
you
and,
very much.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Thanks, Susan.
Thank you.
All right. And we're going to go to Gina. Gina, are you there?
I am.
Hi.
Hi, Chris.
Hi. Question, comment?
Yes, I have a couple. One is a comment before I forget. Recently, a good friend who is of the Buddhist bent and Unitarian Universalist as well convened a group of women who wanted to talk about end of life and aging. And it's been a book group. And one of the books we read, I would like to recommend just on the topic of dying, and that is The Five Invitations. And that book is written by a man whose name I just flew out of my mind. I'm not home to look at it, but he is the first person to have started a Zen hospice in San Francisco. And he's worked with dying folks.
Is it B.J. Miller?
Years. No.
No.
That's something like that.
I think it's Frank Ostaseski.
Yes,
right.
That's it. Ostaseski, that's it. Anyway, that was really a meaningful book to me. I listened to it on Audible, and he reads it. So it was even more amazing because his voice is so soothing and calm and beautiful. And anyway, I recommend that book. But the question I have is, so I was given an advance directive form, a green piece of paper by my cardiologist's office. And, you know, every time I go in there, which isn't that often, but every year or 6 months, they go, do you have an advance directive? And I'm like, no, because I took one look at that thing and I went, how the heck do I know what I want? And I put it away. So I'm gonna take this 10-day challenge. And then, so my question is, how do you, you know, when you're 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, you may have totally different points of view. I'm 74 now, and so it's, you know, I'm getting old, and I don't know what I want. I don't know what to say. I do know I don't want to be in a vegetative state, and that's about as far as it goes in my mind right now. But how do you know if you don't want heroic measures taken if you have a massive heart attack or whatever? That's one question. Well, then the other is your is what you say in your will, if you haven't gotten around to getting a trust yet, which we haven't, but what you say in your will and what you say on your advance directive, are those two different legal things? And can you just put your advance directive, I mean, do you need to have a separate document, or can it just be in your will? I guess because you don't get the will out until right. after the person has died, right?
So, yes, they are two separate documents. The will has to do with your property and the disbursement right. of all of your assets. The Advanced Healthcare Directive is specific to healthcare needs and decisions, and it is something that should be in the hands of the individual who is going to be your proxy or
right,
all of the
right.
individuals who will be your proxy.
Right.
It should be given to your physician so they have
uh-huh.
a copy. And Susan, who called earlier, Sandra had mentioned the word pulsed, which is a physician order for life-sustaining treatment. And it is actually a physician order. It is much smaller, and it is a condensed version of an Advanced Healthcare Directive. You actually should have both. It really gets down to just kind of the brass tacks. And Karen, do you want to explain about the pulsed?
Yes. Well, the pulsed is important because it's usually used when you know that you have a terminal condition.
I see.
Or you are in the end stages of a chronic disease, and the doctor will create it with you. The pulsed travels with the patient. So it could be a patient who's in a nursing home, who has a cardiac arrest in the nursing home. The pulsed form gives orders to every medical person who might find that patient, whether they're EMTs or nurses, orders, and they might say, do not resuscitate this patient. And they can, that gives them the legal right to not offer that care. Otherwise, if they come across a patient who's had an arrest, they're kind of obligated to do CPR if they don't have some other paperwork available that tells them not to. So the pulsed has more clout to it because it's an actual doctor's order. And so it can't be overridden, and it can't be ignored by the medical staff when it's there.
Okay. And then, so this advanced directive for making decisions about health care, we do have that. But this form they gave me at the cardiologist's office is maybe it's just...
Is it two sides? It's a front and back side?
I think so.
You may have a pulsed...
Oh, it, I see.
It
and
may
that's
be
why
the
doctors.
It
want
may
it.
Be the pulsed. Yeah.
Okay.
And
all right. Well, I'll have to look into all of this. And what was the book that you? Is it Susan's book that you're referring people to?
The one that Karen was referring to.
Yeah. I'm sorry. There's a book you've been referring to. Which is that?
On VSED, Dr. Wyatt.
Oh.
Dr. Wyatt's book.
My book is called What Really Matters, Seven Lessons for Living from the Stories of the Dying by Karen Wyatt. So that's
okay.
my book.
Okay.
I did want to say my take is that complete your advanced directives now
yes.
as if you might need them now for the state of health you're in right now, and then revisit them every few years. And when your health status changes, maybe you're right. Your ideas of what you want might change. And it could be that right now you're saying, hey, I'm a healthy person. If something happens and my heart stops, you better do CPR on me and see if you can bring me back. But that might change 5 years from now. And so...
Right.
Start with where you are, and then rethink and revise those forms as you go over time.
Well, I just think it's really important to talk about this and think about this, and the book group kind of has got me more thinking about it, and maybe I'll suggest some of these things to the group the next time we meet.
I think it's great that you're doing a book group,
yeah.
Gina. That's terrific.
Yeah, and we finished all the books now, and now we're deciding where are we going from here. Maybe we need to go to completing some of this stuff and talking a little bit more about
And that. I will say that also Dr. Wyatt has a book group, and she does it online, but also has books that she suggests, and then also has questions that she provides about the book. So did you want to talk about that, Dr. Wyatt?
Thank you very much. I'm going to hang up now.
Okay, Gina, thanks.
Okay.
Bye-bye. You can listen.
All right. Bye-bye. The reading group is called A Year of Reading Dangerously. And so it's a reading group for 2018. We're reading one book a month about death and dying. And there are almost 1,000 people now who've signed up for it from all over the world, actually. And so I get emails and comments from people everywhere. So we're all reading the same book every month, which is actually really interesting when you think about it. You know, this many people coming together and reading the same thing. And at the end of each month, we have an online discussion about the book. And several times already, authors have joined us, the authors of the books, and talked about their books.
So. Which is great. You had Katie call in on Knocking on Heaven's Door, didn't you?
Yes, Katie Butler. It was really wonderful to talk to her about her book.
Which actually is a great book to read if you're questioning whether or not you should have an advanced healthcare directive.
Oh, absolutely. That's a great book, full of resources and information, but it will definitely wake you up.
So if Gina is listening, it's Knocking on Heaven's Door by Katie Butler. And if you just joined us and you want to hear this entire show, all our local shows on KCBX are available on demand by going to kcbx.org and clicking on the on demand under the How to Listen tab on our menu. Then you just select the show you want in the drop down box, like Central Coast Voices, and you'll be able to pick one. My guest today is Dr. Karen Wyatt, creator and host of the End of Life University. And we're talking today about the importance of making our own healthcare decisions known before it's time for us to use them at the end of life, when we can't make them in our own way for ourselves. We have about 10 minutes left for today's show. And I'm going to take a call here from Richard. Richard, are you there? Richard?
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Hi, Chris. Hi, Karen.
Hey, how are you?
Hi, Richard.
I recently completed my advanced healthcare directive and also a DNR.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and for people who don't know, that's a do not resuscitate, right?
Yeah, do not resuscitate.
Mm-hmm.
So I wear a medallion around my neck, the DNR medallion,
mm-hmm.
and I also carry my DNR in my glove compartment of my car.
Mm-hmm.
And with my advanced healthcare directive, I have a proxy and two alternates, and I sent them the copies, and it was very interesting because they really got involved with me. They had questions, and not only questions of you know, what they should do and how they should take care of it, but also questions about my decisions. And that prompted them to want to complete their advanced healthcare directives or change theirs.
Hmm. Can you give an example of something? Go ahead.
An example of?
Of a directive that you gave that somebody was looking at and going, gee, can you explain a little bit more about that?
The biggest example is unless there's something that's acutely traumatic or an infection, I don't want any medical intervention, period.
Okay.
And so, you know, that's very unusual in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so that prompted them to have questions for me about that. And we ended up having conversations, and they ended up thanking me because it was, you know, it prompted them to look at their own values,
mm-hmm.
their own beliefs. So I keep a copy of my advanced health care directive in my file cabinet at home, also in our fire safe. Our attorney has one that he keeps with the will, which is a separate document. And then, like I said, I also have one in my car. So if I get in an accident, which actually almost happened about a month ago, I almost got in a head-on collision, there's a sign on my glove box that says, you know, DNR and Advanced Healthcare Directive in the glove box. Mm. And so hopefully that combined with my medallion that I wear will keep me from having any unwanted medical intervention.
You took this really seriously.
Well, my worst nightmare, Chris, is that I wake up in the hospital, or maybe don't wake up in the hospital, but I'm in a coma in the hospital, you know, with a, you know, breathing tube and artificial nutrition, and, you know, I just don't want any of that. And I understand that emergency medical personnel have to treat me unless there's some, like Karen said, unless there's some overwhelming documentation and reason why not to.
Yeah.
Well, I would say congratulations, yeah. Richard. You've done a really thorough job. And also, you've chosen some really good people as healthcare proxy and alternate because the fact that they were willing to think it over and ask questions, I think that's exactly what we're all mm-hmm. hoping for, that we'll have someone who cares that much, that they really want to understand our wishes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And like you were talking about earlier in this show, the conversation is so important, not only with others, like we were just talking about, but with yourself. You know, the conversation I had to have with myself while composing my wishes was priceless. And I found that, you know, in embracing the, I'm going to say probability that one day I'm going to die, while embracing that, you know, a lot of fears that I've had in life became diminished, and I feel like I can embrace life more fully.
That's great. Richard, I really appreciate you calling in and sharing.
Thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Karen, we've got about 2 minutes, and I want to make sure that we're wrapping up with you. Please tell people how they can get to your online university, University for End of Life.
They can go to eoluniversity.com. And on that homepage, they'll find links to most of what we've been talking about, the reading group, the challenge, the 10-day challenge, to the interviews that I do online, and lots of other information on that website. So it's eoluniversity.com.
And as you were mentioning to one of our guests, too, if you're doing an advanced healthcare directive, it's always revisable, and you're advised to do that, to update it during your life when there's a major event or just when you're changing. Maybe you change religion, you change partners, you want to change who your proxy is, right?
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
Okay, well, I appreciate you being here, and thank you. I want to thank Dr. Karen Wyatt, our guest today. Next week, please join Fred Monroe as he speaks with guests from the Opera of San Luis Obispo, the region's only professional opera company, as they talk about their history and how they collaborate with other nonprofit organizations and community art groups to bring an array of events to the Central Coast. Central Coast Voices is sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities and the San Luis Obispo Community Foundation in collaboration with KCBX and made possible through underwriting by Joan Gellard Sargent. I'm Chris Kington Barker. Thank you for joining me on Central Coast Voices, and thank you to all those who called in to help expand our show.